Well, hello everyone. Says that I'm live here, and so I'm hoping so. Hey, Giovanni and South and Lord Anubis and everybody who asked me all these crazy questions, Ancient Vacuum. After about 10 minutes, I will be bringing in Chris Cottrell from the Dabbler's Den. He's going to talk about the Carolina Bays some. He reached out to me after I'd already announced this, but I wanted to make sure and give you, my hardcore followers, a chance to go ahead and ask me these crazy questions. So, what do you got, guys? You got anything silly here? Yes, I agree. Graham Hancock's video response was great. He even had this hairy guy on there that was all right. Let's see here what we got here. Milo or Dan, such a tough choice. If you even have to make that decision, I'm sorry for you. You pick between Pink Floyd or freaking Britney Spears. I'm giving away my age here. Shit. Yes, Shaman, we will be discussing the Bays. Yeah, it was him saying super sexy D did make me chuckle. Did Christopher Dunn falsify a drill core experiment? Well, you know, Rue, I don't know that he did, but I will be looking into some of this and talking to him about it. But yeah, I'll probably try to couch in a little bit better terminology than, hey man, are you full of shit? Call me crazy. I suppose almost anything means you want to tell me your Steam password. Yeah, I don't have a Steam account. My son does. I'm old. I game on a Sega Saturn. If I do get online to game, I play like Hearthstone and old shit like that. Fortnite on his account. Way past your bedtime. Sorry, Charles. Okay, let's see. All right. Anyone got any? I'll give you a couple more minutes here, but then I'm going to go ahead and bring in Chris if there's if none of you want to really ask anything, because that's fine by me. Did I see Dibble and Hoops pre-bunky? No, I saw the thumbnail. I didn't bother watching it because you know, call me crazy. I could be wrong about this, but I'm gonna go out on a limb and say that Graham didn't give them any pertinent information, so they probably have no fucking clue what, you know, is in actual Ancient Apocalypse season two. Considering that Flint doesn't even understand Graham's basic position from Ancient Apocalypse season one, or even Fingerprints of the Gods, I wouldn't be surprised at all if they have no idea. So I will watch it at some point, but I'll probably wait until after the season comes out, the series comes out, just to like mock how hilariously wrong they were. Do you enjoy Grand Concock eloquently destroying Dibble? Yes, that was pretty good. I did definitely enjoy watching that video. I've been waiting for something like that for a long time. Hey, Homefront. Hello, Heather. Okay, Lord Anubis asks, what is your top three pieces of evidence that convinced you that something is wrong with the suggested view of ancient history, and was there some ancient advanced civilization? Advanced, I would say. Yes, to a degree, not to the degree that a lot of people think with lasers and spaceships and cars and all that. I'm more like they were really a lot better seafarers than they're giving credit for at the time. As far as the top three pieces of evidence, the number one thing I talk about before, like the Great Pyramid, the way that it was built and the way that that's dismissed by academia is kind of a gateway drug into being a pyramidiot. If they would actually address that, they might find less people jumping into the alternate history sphere. But as it is, if your whole position is, hi, you know, this was done in 20 years, to hell with what all the guys that actually know this stuff, know anything about construction, I have to say, we've got these timelines over here. Yeah, that's this first one. And the second one is the way that certain things are dismissed, or like the architecture between Easter Island and Peru. That was a great example of things that were just dismissed for a long time, and it does pop up. These similarities that are, well, there's more to it than academia gives it credit for, until eventually they're drug into seeing it. And the next one is the way that certain aspects of archaeoastronomy that aren't necessarily something that would be like a natural, something that everybody would think up on their own, kind of spread across the globe. There are certain things like the Great Hunt and stuff like that associated with Orion that just spread far beyond what mainstream academia would suggest that cultures touched. All right. What else we got here? Am I familiar with Doug Vautrin's theories regarding a polar Earth reversal and Earth's rotation? I'm not completely. I've heard some about that, and there is some truth to that astronomically. Like the poles will switch from time to time, and there's, I mean, this is a true thing, but I haven't looked into a lot of particular theories on that. Am I planning to make another response to David Miano? Of course. This is a Dedunking channel. David Miano's as much a regular here as Graham Hancock is on David Miano's channel. Big Rolling Home asks, the level of ancient technology would equate to what Professor had on Gilligan's Island. Yeah, no, I don't think so. Have I seen the scanning electron microscope of devices, titanium and iron potentially embedded inside? That is interesting, but it's also, this is where I will have to agree with the skeptics that the provenance is kind of a big deal. When you don't know where the thing's been for the last 5,000 years, having titanium in the grooves isn't nearly as big of a deal as if they were dug up out of the ground, shoved in a museum, and have titanium in the grooves. That's kind of frustrating. But as usual, I wouldn't discourage them from looking into it. It's just, this is one thing that I would definitely want provenance to be a lot better on before I hung my hat on that. Geomagnetic excursion and the cyclical catastrophe event is on the horizon. Possibly. I'll look into that some, but those kinds of doomsday things are less interesting to me. You know, a lot of people are into that thing, but it, you know, if the world's going to end, it's going to end. And I tend to, like, the things that are all doomsday don't seem to attract my attention as much. Matter of fact, even though I thought the Mayan 2012 stuff was pretty interesting, I always used to joke around about it back in 2010 and 2011 that I just thought it was a nothing burger. But I thought it was, my joke was always, if these guys sacrificed a bunch of people trying to put off the end of the world, then who are we to say that didn't work? It was 2014, 2022, 2083. Watch the whole Hoops Dibble podcast. It was pretty flat. I think they were just using Graham's fame to get subscribers. Rue, that is standard operating procedure for those guys. Oh, if you're an archaeologist and you're a content creator and your views are flagging a little bit, go talk about Graham Hancock. You are guaranteed to get plenty of haters in your comment section just saying all kinds of random stuff, but they click on things and they watch ads. So, you know, it works out. Oh, you know, questions here. What we got? I wouldn't mind to get to Serpent Mound. That wouldn't be bad. If I do, I'll have to talk to, what was the dude's name that I talked to before? Doggone it, I called him up, and now I forget his name. But he was on Ancient Apocalypse. I gave him a call. He was a really nice guy to talk to. I wish archaeologists would embrace the amateurs out of their box thinking. Every now and again they do. The problem is if we step on their toes out the gate, they seem very susceptible to knee-jerk reactions, and they're not very good at detecting. They're not very self-aware. That's the word I'm looking for. Like, I'm not very good with words sometimes. Suspicious observers. You want to know about electromagnetic flipping? I'll check it out one of these days. Skeletons in the Cupboard documentary. I have not. That would be interesting, though. The Maori are pretty interesting stuff. Much love from Sweden. Thank you, thank you. Oh, somebody's giving me a super chat, and I done missed it because I'm looking through other stuff. What we got here? Do you believe that water coming from the top of the edge of a cliff could be made to produce hydropneumatic suction and tunnels emptying into the valley from the edge? Fuck, I don't know. I mean, I would imagine that would be feasible. There's some pretty crazy stuff. Like when they see water falling down, big waterfalls and stuff here in Washington State, they did it like in the last couple hundred years, they put a early hydroelectric plant. And it was in a place that was, you would look at it and be like, man, there ain't no way in hell they're going to make that work. But they did. And the waterfall's still there. Man, they're leeching power off of it. Hello, Emma. Hello, First Sir. Kandui. CNSI, Greenless Ice Today, 2012. Yeah, that's that one. There's a good point, Dan, but also helps understand the explanations of ventilation. I am not a Mason, Jenny. I'm sorry. I was an electrician, but I'm not a Freemason either. Astronomers do engage with the amateur community a lot. They have Carl Sagan as a touchstone instead of Flint Dibble, so there's that. Am I going to do a videos on am I going to do another video on Dibble? Yeah, I've got a video of him on the works. His rebuttal to Hancock's recent video, we'll see. I haven't even watched a lot of his stuff yet. I do, contrary to popular belief, I don't watch everything of his that he makes all the time. I get bored of it pretty quick. But I will, I'm working on a video now that's covering a paper that him and a few other guys wrote that's just atrocious. Thanks, Rue, for sending me that, by the way. It's taking forever to dig through this. Oh, my God. Have I seen Dibble's ex-post from January 5th? He claims to have not ever called Hancock a racist. But, yeah, he does all the time. He knows he does all the time. He says it all the time that he doesn't, but he very much calls Hancock a racist all the time. Does that mean Donnelly or Hancock are racist? No. Okay, let's. Dismissive attitude of archaeologists. Do I think that it's their professional? Lord Anubis asks, do you think the dismissive attitude of archaeologists is just professional blinders, or are they actively trying to hide something? If the latter, what? I think It's professional blinders, and I think a lot of it is ego driven, and I think a lot of it is like just keeping yourself alive. If your job is to go out and like before Clovis first, there was the Folsom first, and it was the exact same thing. Folsom points, first culture in the Americas. If you challenge it, your career is threatened. And because it's so long ago, you don't really hear archaeologists talking back against that. You go look on Wikipedia, it flat out says it, the Folsom, if you disagree with the Folsom first theory back in those days, you were crucified. It took Clovis first a long time to get through. What it seems is in archaeology, there's a lot of soft science attached to the hard science. They dig up real data, get real carbon dating, and then they make up this hypothesis. It's based on an educated guess. I think that that is where there's a lot of room for ego to be injected. This is my hypothesis. I thought it up. Me and my colleagues dreamt it up. We fleshed it out over the decades, and now you're coming along and saying this is just Harry Potter. Fuck you. I think that's where a lot of that comes from. I don't think it's as much a conspiracy, although, I could be wrong in that regards. I'm open to the possibility. It's just that the evidence at that point, I am skeptical, and I do need some overwhelming evidence. Rocky, I will be talking at the Cosmic Summit. Thank you, by the way. I'm excited to be going to the Cosmic Summit too. I will be discussing basically the biggest thing I'll be talking about is just trying to inoculate people against kind of fake debunkings, just the psychology behind it, what to look for when you're being bullshat by somebody who's wearing a lab coat. Oh, and I'm getting ready to bring on Chris here in a minute, but I'm gonna go through here really quick. Am I still pulling wire? Am I done with that? Homefront, in 2008, the stock market collapsed. I lost my job because rich guys were gambling on houses and they no longer needed me to put wire in them anymore. Since then, if you want me to put on my tool belt, it's going to cost you a whole lot more than you're going to think it's worth. And yeah, the answer is basically no. I'll help out a friend every now and again, but I've been requested numerous times to do real jobs, and the answer is always no. Hey, Dan, what do you think about the Stonehenge in Lake Michigan? That's interesting stuff. I haven't done a ton of research. It seems like there's a lot of geologists that think it's not that big of a deal, that it's a nothing burger, but who knows? Lord Anubis, the thing that was most interesting to me that I've discovered so far when I was like digging through things was probably, to be honest with you, the Antikythera mechanism. When I first saw that when I was a younger man, I blew my mind. I was just like five tech levels above what I expected to see. Sounds, I know it's mundane, but that's me, right? Rar. Oh, cool. No. Okay. I think I'm going to bring Chris on here in just a minute. Just juggling through to make sure I didn't miss anything real fast. Sorry that I'm going through it backwards, guys, but I'm old. And this whole chat thing. That's stuff for guys named Charlie and Sneeko, not for me. Plum Bob or Speed Square? Speed Square all the way. How old do I look? All right, I am going to go ahead and add Chris to the stage here. Hey, all right, Chris.
What's up, Dan? How are you? I feel like a third wheel. Like I just got into the car with two other people.
Well, sorry about that. I'm really glad you reached out to me because I always thought that I'm going to have a hard time talking to just the crowd. I'm not. What's that comedian guy's name?
You were rolling.
Bill Burr. Thanks. Yeah. Now, Bill Burr could keep going for like 5 hours just yabbering to nobody, but I'm not. I'm not one of those Twitch streamers. So,
yeah.
Anyway, you've been doing a lot of research into the Carolina Bays over the years. Kind of an expert on that, correct?
Yeah. It didn't start off well. It's really been since 1999, 2000, when I first heard about them. But really after about 2015 is when I started kind of getting into it hardcore. And that was because I got a master's in geoscience, and I finally felt, that I was in a place where I could, talk about it, and started a YouTube channel and all that kind of stuff. And so since then, now I'll be seeing you at the Cosmic Summit again, or I'll be seeing you at the Cosmic Summit this year. I've been speaking there for 2 years now. So, on the Carolina Bays. That's one of George's big pet projects. Carolina Bays is what got him into it. That's what got guys like Randall Carlson into it. Carolina Bays they're just fascinating. They're really, really a fascinating geologic feature. It's really kind of been interesting for the past few years.
So. Yeah, it's something that people have asked me about a lot, but I get asked about so many things that, and when I started doing live streams, I found that it was just easier just to bring in the horse's mouth, so to speak. It's, you know, a lot. Why should I try to reinterpret everything Chris has already said, put a link to his channel, when I could just bring Chris on and then you can tell everybody that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. So they are, I mean, they are pretty cool. I don't know if you want to show some images and, you know, cause it's such a visual topic, you know, you really need to have something to look at, when you're talking about Carolina Bays. I start with, you know, I am a secondary science educator. I teach at a school in coastal Georgia. And I've been teaching now for, I don't know, 23 years, something like that. And one of the things that is so important to me as an educator is just the basic, you know, the processes of science. You know, the scientific method is, you know, so important for anything. And it's one of the things that I try to drive into the students that I'm teaching is, you know, everyone is a scientist. You know, we all have the ability to go through the steps as a scientist in a lab coat. And it doesn't matter if you're trying to fix a car, if you're, you know, trying to solve an electrical problem, or just, you know, trying to figure out what you want to eat for breakfast. You know, it's one of those things where, you know, you go through those steps every single day, multiple times a day. You know, you state a problem, you gather the information, you form a hypothesis, and then you have to be able to test that hypothesis. And, you know, this is what we do day in and day out. And it's one of the things that, you know, we need to look for when we're looking at scientists. You know, when we're looking at, you know, what's going on in the field of archaeology, what's going on in the field of geology, you know, are the steps of the scientific method being followed? And is it replicable? Is it something that we can all do? And we're in a time and a place now where we can, you know, we have the technologies now where, you know, just any, you know, if you have a computer now or a cell phone, you know, you've got at your fingertips exactly what, you know, a scientist in a lab coat has to solve those same exact problems. And, you know, there's actually a term called avocationalist, which I really like. You know, it's kind of, I prefer that from a, you know, a pajama scientist or an amateur. You know, that's basically, you know, the term is the same thing, but an avocationalist gives it a little bit, you know, it makes you feel a little better. But, you know, and as a matter of fact, you know, you had a video a couple weeks ago on J. Harlan Brett's. And, you know, the story of J. Harlan Brett's fascinates me. And, you know, it was a group of school teachers up in your neck of the woods that, you know, solved the problem of these mega floods 100 years ago, you know, and we're just now catching up to what they were doing 100 years ago. And so, you know, again, I think we're in a place now where, you know, a lot of us can get involved and a lot of us can participate in these things.
Well, yeah, I mean, we can all look on Google Earth and see what J. Harlan Brett's had to hike 3 days to see from a worm's eye view, right? Yeah. And now if I decide to retrace his steps and I end up way out in the middle of God's country, I can launch a drone and get a bird's eye view of the area that he had to painstakingly map out. So it's no surprise. I mean, it is frustrating that it wasn't picked up on after he started publishing the aerial photography. That's kind of amazing. But it's no mm-hmm. surprise that in the early days that it was just categorically rejected because it's the kind of thing you don't see really anywhere else on the planet. So you just mm-hmm. figure this guy's blowing smoke to make a name for himself. That would have been right. A typical knee-jerk reaction. But nowadays, I mean, hell, like you say, we can all get involved. Somebody sitting, I see there's YouTubers that sit there on Google Earth and go find something weird and then go hike to it. Mm-hmm. That's what they do.
Yep. 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 And, you know, the parallels between that story, I see the parallels with the Carolina Bays. You know, we do have the ability now to look down onto the ground, you know, and form hypotheses of our own, you know, and go out and be able to test those hypotheses and try to solve this problem. Because make no mistake about it, it's the Carolina Bays are a mystery. You know, they're not, it hasn't been solved. You know, there are some mainstream ideas. There are some ideas from guys like me and Antonio Zamora Michael Davis and guys that we'll talk about here in a few minutes. But you know, being able to have a hypothesis that can be tested is super important.
Yes, so, yes it is. Yeah. Let me quickly thank Rue for the ticket price there. Rue, you're awesome. I appreciate you always throwing a couple of bucks at me when we get started.
You know, while we're talking about that real quick, you know, something that I always think about, you know, there seems to be like a value for value model when it comes to these live streams. And I think about how much, you know, growing up, because we're about the same age, I think, you know, we're, you know, and I think about how much money I wasted on like magazines growing up, you know, like I grew up on the East Coast surfing. And I would have like two or three surfing magazines show up at my house, and they were, you know, $3 or $4, you know, a month for each one of those. And they all ended up in the trash. You know, the value for value for something like a magazine subscription was ridiculous. And, you know, so for guys to throw in these, you know, live chats, the super chats and things like that, that's, to me, you're getting real value. And so
yeah,
it's totally worth the $3 or $4 that people toss, you know, toss into the hat. So,
well, yeah, definitely keep it, makes them more viable to do. And I enjoy these a lot because I try to make, you know, it's kind of a catch 22. I try to make high level content. I don't want to just crank things out. At the same time, if people want me to make as much content as I can and do this for a living, in order to do that, I need as much money coming in as more than what it is, when, especially when I started, but even more than where we're at now. But it's getting there. But so the live streams, the super chats and stuff, not to hound about it, but it definitely does matter. So I do appreciate it much. And really quick, the chats, a few people have asked about Graham Hancock featuring me in the last video. Yes, I love that very much. Of course, that was pretty awesome. I do talk to Graham from time to time, so I knew that he was going to use me, because he asked me if it would be okay if he used clips of mine, like he needed to, but he did. Mm-hmm. I never asked him when I use his clips, but
you got to make a small clip of him saying "super sexy D," because that's gold right there.
I did, actually. I made a short with Walter White going, "Say my name, super sexy D." Okay. You're goddamn right. No, it's all right. It's just a short. YouTube never shows my shorts to anybody anymore. I get more views in my live chats than I do shorts. That's why I never make them. But so it was cute. Yeah, the super sexy D. I was drinking a beer when I watched him. I was just like, I spit across the room practically. Goddamn, you gotta be kidding me, man. that nice proper British accent. Super sexy.
Yeah. Right.
But anyway, back to the Carolina Bays. So what first got you into these?
Well, like, so I went to school at my undergraduate was from Valdosta State University. And one of the places that we went to on a field trip was a place called Grand Bay. And, you know, when we got there, again, this was in 1999. You go out there and it's a swamp. You know, we live in, it's kind of close to the Okefenokee. So everything down there is really swampy anyways. And, there's like a 100-foot tower. And so we all go out there, walk down this, you know, 1,000-yard boardwalk, and then climb a 100-foot tower. And you can see all the way around you. And it looks like a perfect circle once you get up to the top. And, you know, we were asking questions, and, you know, they were telling us that this was a Carolina Bay. And it's not perfectly circular. It's actually elliptical. And they told us that it was a mystery. You know, like, they don't know how they formed, you know, and they favor the wind-oriented and water hypothesis for how they formed. But there's other hypotheses out there. And even back in 1999, asteroids were brought up, you know, that this could be the result of some type of impact that took place. And so that sparked my, you know, I think I was 20 years old. That sparked my brain, like, ooh, a mystery? You know, I'll be the first one to jump into Shaggy's mystery machine, and off we go, you know? So, you know, that intrigued me back in college. And back then I was taking a bunch of geology classes. I took, you know, just about every geology and geography class that Valdosta State offered, mainly because I was trying to bring up my GPA. I really, really goofed my freshman year of college, and it was almost the end. And so I had to bring up my GPA, and I really enjoyed geology. So I took every course that they had. I ended up with two minors. And so I've always been really interested in geology and geography and things like that. Back in 2015 is when I got a master's degree in geoscience to go along with my master's degree in education. And the reason why I bring that up is because sometimes I feel like a bridge between like the super skeptical and the academic scientist on a lot of these topics. You know, there's been a lot of talk about Flint Dibble and John Hoops. I'm probably still call him Hoops, but
a weasel by any other name.
Yeah. Well, here's the thing, though, is, you know, I have never personally met an archaeologist that I didn't like. You know, sure. I've never met in person, you know, an archaeologist that I didn't like. I've almost every geologist I've had an encounter with has been, you know, super pleasant and helpful and things like that. And I think that even with like Flint Dibble, you know, I'm sure if it was just him and I hanging out, and we'd probably be good friends, same thing with John Hoops. One of the things that really bothers me though, is how they treat the younger Dryas. And we'll talk about that here in a few minutes, because that's part of the story of the Carolina Bays. But they, you know, you had a video a couple weeks ago about John Hoops and how he, I don't know if he still does, but he was very involved in the Wikipedia page for the Younger Dryas. I have no idea why that would be something he's qualified to do. It's really, I don't get it at all. Like, yeah, he's an archaeologist in Central America. You know, why is he, what's he have to do with a cometary impact, you know?
Mark Young from the Comet Research Group told me that when he was trying to edit that Wikipedia page, they wouldn't let him. He was banned from it for a conflict of interest because he's part of the Comet Research Group.
Yeah.
It's like, well, what the hell are you talking about, man? So is John Hoops banned from weighing in on my Central American research? Of course not.
I'm sure he's got his fingers all on that wiki page. So
exactly. They've weaponized it, clearly.
Yeah, and I've just lost all. Yeah, in my opinion, it has no credibility, and I don't even check Wikipedia anymore. I tell my students, I'm like, it's most of that's garbage. Just move on, go find other actual, you know, first person references for research. But I do tell them that Wikipedia is good for finding references, you know, because everything is cited in Wikipedia. But it's like, don't you cite that Wikipedia page?
Yeah, because a lot of times you'll click on the reference and it's like, how the hell did they get what they put in the Wikipedia
sometimes,
page
for
this
sure.
reference? A lot of times I don't understand at all.
Yeah.
Oh, I got it from admin. I didn't know I had an admin. Hi, admin. Ooh. Thanks. I enjoy you enjoy my content style and my beard. Well, I appreciate that. Thank you very much.
I had a beard going until about a week ago, and I just the mustache. I couldn't do the mustache anymore. I had to shave it back again. So
I understand. Yeah. I trimmed it up pretty good when I first started and everybody yelled at me. So I have to just let it go now.
it's getting to be hunting season here in coastal Georgia. And so I used to grow face camo. And, but as I keep getting older, it keeps turning colors. And now it looks like a white-tailed deer's ass. So
it doesn't work. Huh?
No,
they have just for hunting hair coloring.
Yeah, right.
Camo wash it out butter. After a day.
Yeah. So, anyways, you know, the reason why I brought up the scientific method with the Carolina Bays is to bring up variables, because you know when you are testing a hypothesis, you know, including variables is really important. It's going to be one of the things that I think is important for the current academic hypothesis for Carolina Bays. I don't think they're really accounting for all the variables. And so I'm sure that's something we'll get into here in a few minutes, but that's why I have a whole slide on the scientific method. So let's go ahead and go to the next page. We talk about what Carolina Bays are, because, you know, a lot of people, you know, when I first started doing this, nobody has heard of Carolina Bays, you know, unless you live in an area where somebody's, because people live all throughout these areas of the Carolinas, North Carolina, South Carolina, Georgia, where there are thousands and thousands of these Carolina Bays, and they have no clue that they even exist. You know, the Native Americans use them all the time. They actually call them Pocosins, which is actually, it means swamp on a hill. It was a good place to find waterfowl. And so there was always a lot of good duck hunting and you know, migrational goose hunting and things like that. You know, they're very unique. They are elliptical shaped. They have an elliptical shaped geometry. Most of them do have raised sandy rims, which is an important feature of the Carolina Bays. And to me, I think one of the most interesting common feature that these Carolina Bays have is that they're all radially oriented to the Great Lakes. And that's kind of an important feature that they all share. They're all oriented towards the Great Lakes, and they go by many names. In Maryland, they're called Maryland Basins, and the Delmarva Peninsula, they go by Delmarva Bays. And they have them all the way over in Nebraska too, which is really interesting. We'll talk about those in just a few minutes, but you know, we have this radial orientation back to the Great Lakes, you know, about 1500 kilometers away from the Great Lakes going all the way around. That should be very telling on what these things might be. You know, so again, I'm obviously in the camp of a cosmic impact. And I think that cosmic impact originated in, you know, the Michigan area when there was ice cover on top of it. Now we'll talk about when that might happen in a few minutes, because that's a little controversial. Actually, the whole thing is controversial, but yeah. Now, the first time we saw these Carolina Bays was back in the 1930s. And so it kind of does mirror that J. Harlan Brett's story in this case as well, because, you know, we're looking at 100 years ago that we first were able to see Carolina Bays. And it's because we were able to get up high enough. We were able to look down. If you go to the next slide, there's a picture that was used as, it was the Fairchild Aerial Surveys for the Ocean Forest Company. And it's a mosaic, but you know, back in the 1930s, we had airplanes and we were able to get high enough, and all the pilots were amazed. You know, they were flying over these elliptical shapes and their jaws dropped. You know, what the heck is this thing? And again, they were back in the 1930s. This was during the time of right before the Dust Bowl. And so there was a lot of agricultural studies taking place, trying to figure out how we're going to grow more food for a growing population. And so they started to take just hundreds and hundreds of pictures of this area. This is actually down closer to Myrtle Beach. They were very pronounced. You know, again, it was really dry anyways during that time. And so those elliptical shapes were really highlighted. But yeah, there are hundreds of pictures stitched together right here to make this mosaic. And, you know, they thought that these things were formed by some form of cosmic impact. And back then they thought that it was bolide events. Like, you know, these comets were, we went through a time of like a super serious meteor shower, and we just got plugged. I mean, we just got hit like a shotgun blast. And then these were all, you know, the results of a cosmic impact. The problem is that they never found any meteor fragments inside these Carolina Bays. They found, you know, lots of other stuff, Native American artifacts and things like that, but they didn't find any meteorites. So if you go to the next slide, you know, it kind of sets up a, you know, that classic, you know, debate between the terrestrial or the uniformitarianism model of how these things could have formed versus a catastrophic, you know, cosmic impact on how they could have formed. And so, and this has been going back and forth for literally 100 years. And we still don't know. It's still a mystery. We don't have a set answer yet on how these things formed. And we know that we get hit by cosmic debris. You know, we every year we go through meteor showers. Every year we can plan for, you know, meteor events, and they're tracking some bigger ones. And just, I think a couple months ago, there was a good chunk of space debris they were tracking, and they were able to follow it all the way in as it made a fireball coming in. But again, you know, when it comes to big impacts, the mainstream scientists tend to steer clear. They tend to go for a uniformitarianism model that, you know, things change very slowly over time, you know, one grain of sand and one gust of wind at a time. And that's kind of been the most dominant explanation for the Carolina Bays. And like, as I'll show you, you know, there's not a lot to back that.
It's kind of sidestep really quick, or to weigh in on that real quick. I've talked about the uniformitarianism versus catastrophism debate numerous times, and how it was, how that pendulum swung back and forth based on basically the religious ideology of the time. You know, when science's job is to promote the Bible, it's all catastrophism. Mm-hmm. When science's job is to prove the Bible's not right, it's uniformitarianism. And it's really funny. It's like it really took until the KT impact before the two started to get like accepted mainstream in the sciences, because it's the kind of thing that this is the kind of shit that a kid can figure out. It's like sometimes one drop of water goes into the bathtub and that will slowly fill the bathtub, but I can also turn that faucet on and just make it come rushing in there like crazy. It's so basic.
Right. And we grew up with this. We grew up with the dinosaurs being, you know, going extinct by a cosmic impact. You know, it was like the early 80s that they, you know, the Alvarez team, I think it's the Alvarez's, that first, you know, discovered that black mat layer that had high levels of iridium. And you know, for almost two decades, well, about a decade and a half, it was going back and forth. And it was the 1990s when they finally were like, they found the Chicxulub crater down in Mexico. Yeah. They followed the cenotes that formed that, you know, half arc. And they went and investigated it, and sure enough, they're like, oh, there's a huge crater down here, guys. And that was what finally like convinced the most of the mainstream scientists, like, okay, you guys got us, you know, you're right. And that was like in the 90s. And I was, you know, that's when I was in high school. So, now I will say that, you know, when I first, you know, as a little kid heard that it could have been an impact, I was like, duh, that, of course that's what did it, you know? so to have them catch up as I was graduating high school, or, you know, in the middle of high school, it's like, well, what took you guys so long? So anyways, but yeah, that's kind of where, you know, it's just been going back and forth between that, you know, and there's a lot of things, you know, there are a lot of places where uniformitarianism is important, you know, but I think you use the term, you know, punctuated uniformitarianism, and I think that's the best way to go about it. The best way to look at it is that, you know, these things occur, and they tend to alter that uniformitarianism process, and you know, I think that's what happened to form these Carolina Bays. There was an event at some point that you know, really shook the earth and created these elliptical shapes, which we'll get into more here in a few minutes. Now, there have been lots of hypotheses for the Carolina Bays. If you go to the next slide, I have a list of them. You know, this is just a list of hypotheses, and this is just some of them. I mean, they you go back 100 years and there are just paper after paper after paper. And actually, let me rephrase that, because there's really not a lot of research on the Carolina Bays. So it's really not paper after paper, but, you know, there were hypotheses that popped up and fizzled out and popped up and fizzled out. Things like spring basins. You know, I have on there the craters from meteor swarms. That was on there. But they were going kind of back and forth, but in leaning in favor of a terrestrial uniformitarianism hypothesis, the most plausible hypothesis for that team of you know, the uniformitarianism was wind and water, that over a long period of time, wind blew over, katabatic winds coming off of the Laurentide ice sheet, you know, blew across land and hit ponds of water and swirled them around long enough to form perfect ellipses. And that's kind of where we're at with it right now. If you go to the next slide, one of the problems that I have with that is that, you know, we have better technology now. You know, we're back in the 1930s, you know, they were flying around in airplanes. I mean, they were flying around in airplanes and taking pictures, but, you know, that, and back then that was top of the line technology. You know, but even when I was in college, you know, in the early 2000s, you know, we were still pasting together aerial photos to make mosaics to get a bigger scale version of what we were looking at on the ground. We had better sources. You know, we were actually, you know, we had better images from airplanes, and they had databases and computers were rolling out. We were able to print off from that database. But we would sit in a lab and we would, you know, stitch together papers and match them and use paste and poster boards and create these mosaics of the ground and, you know, get better images of what these Carolina Bays look like and things like that. But today, I mean, we have access to Google Earth. Everyone, you can get online, you can use it on your phone, and you can pull up, you know, images from all across the world now and look exactly what's going on, you know, on the ground there. And we see these Carolina Bays, we see them all over the place. So yeah, you know, having access to Google Earth is a huge leap ahead. And, you know, I kind of wonder if these early scientists that were, you know, like Melton and Shriver and these guys, if they had access to Google Earth, you know, they would have had a much better chance at pushing a hypothesis that led to more of a cosmic origin than wind and swirling water. And it goes even further today because we have access to things like LIDAR. And if you go to the next slide, you know, LIDAR has become huge for these Carolina Bays. This is that same area in Myrtle Beach, and you can see in the LIDAR how much better you can see these Carolina Bays. I also want to make sure that I point out that Michael Davies is the one who has literally taken USGS LIDAR data and uploaded it to Google Earth. You can go to his website at CentOS.org and access his files to just pull it up right up onto your Google Earth. And he has the entire continental United States now, you know, matched with the USGS LIDAR that he's also gone further and color coded it to represent different colors for every meter. So it's almost like you're looking at LIDAR with topography. You're looking at LIDAR with a topographic map at the same time using the color. In my opinion, it's beautiful. And it helps for places like this. It helps, and especially since he's gone in and marked these Carolina Bays. He's the one who's responsible for tagging, you know, 70,000 of these Carolina Bays, which is slightly less than what they have on Wikipedia right now. Wikipedia still says that there's over almost half a million, 500,000, but there's not. And so, again, why can't we change that? He's literally gone in and tagged at least 70,000 of them. But if you go to Wikipedia, it's still going to say that there's 500,000. And we're actually like making a case that there's less. It's like there's not as many as you guys say there are. There's actually fewer, but they're very well defined. And where you really see it now, if you click to the next slide, you really see it in other places. Like if you go further inland into the coastal plain of South Carolina, North Carolina. In fact, this image right here is close to Tatum, which is in South Carolina, but it's really close to the North Carolina border. And we've gotten pretty good at using Google Earth. You know, you can start seeing if you know what you're looking for, you could see some elliptical shapes there. But there's also, like I said, there's a town there. There's highways. There's farms. There's all the things that we see on Google Earth every time we look at them. But if you click to the next slide.
Oops, sorry.
This is what it looks like now with that LIDAR.
Oh, and wow.
Yeah, it's the same exact. I mean, these are the Carolina Bays. You know, this is what we see when we investigate it with newer technology, when we actually sit down with LIDAR. Again, Michael Davies has color-coded it to be, 1 meter changes color. Every 10 meters, it goes back to the same color. Wow. And so for flat terrain, this is gold. This is perfect. You know, you can see all of these perfectly elliptical shapes. And again, they're perfectly, to me, this looks like a splatter pattern. You know, you kick some water at the beach or something like that, and it lands on the sand. You're going to see perfectly elliptical shapes, you know, and they're overlapping. I find it very difficult to accept that wind and water could do this every time. And that's where the variables are going to come in here in a few minutes. So this is a big deal. This is a big deal. Now, obviously, yeah. You know, I'm in the cosmic impact camp, right? Sure. So if you go to the next slide, again, it's kind of an overview of that. But I, you know, when we look at the Carolina Bays, we look at how perfectly shaped that they are, how they're oriented to the Great Lakes. We'll get into more about the Nebraska rainwater basins here in a little bit, but there's an image there to show where the Nebraska rainwater basin, same exact thing, same exact thing. You got these elliptical shapes with orientation right back to the Great Lakes, right back to the same location on a map. You know, where they all point to, and this is something that, you know, we can get into or not. It's not very well supported, but it is a fact that the area that they all point to is a ring-shaped basin known as the Michigan Basin. I do think that this is part of the story. If you ask a Michigan geologist, they'll laugh in your face and they'll say, no. You know, the Michigan Basin is formed as a bowl and sediment filled into the bowl over time. And which actually completely goes against the geologic law of original horizontality, which basically states that sediment lays flat and it forms flat layers, and then you have a depression or you have a rise to give you, you know, different shapes later. You know, so this basin is exactly where all of these things form. There's also been research done on gravitational anomalies that actually put the Michigan Basin, that area, especially around Saginaw Bay, to have a gravitational anomaly very similar to the Chicxulub crater, the one that took out the dinosaurs down in Mexico, in the Yucatan. So again, there's a lot of research, a lot of branches that can go out from this that definitely needs other people to investigate further. But
yeah, that's one of the things that's kind of consistently comes up when we talk about anything that gets associated with the impact. It gets guys like Hoops that don't really have any place to weighing in and kind of poisoning the well. And then it makes it the real scientists versus the kooks is the way they try to paint it all out at.
Right.
So then you're off in a corner by yourself.
Right.
That's their plan.
Right. Well, luckily I'm not in a corner by myself. Luckily I have a couple buddies.
There you go.
that are scientists. I mean, these guys are very highly acclaimed in their fields of science. It just doesn't happen to be impact science. But they saw this. They use their scientific processes of thinking, and they came up with their own hypotheses, and they've been testing those hypotheses. So you know, if you click to the next slide, it's just I do think that this was formed by a cosmic impact. We'll get into a little bit more about the current academic hypothesis for Carolina Bays in a second. But I just want to go ahead and get it out there that I do think that these were formed by an impact into the ice sheet over Michigan. And it's the ejecta. It's the ice, the glacial ice ejecta that launched away from the impact site. The primary impact site, and that ice was launched and came back down into the coastal plain and other places inland too. But the coastal plain really absorbed the impacts and preserved them in the shape of the Carolina Bays. I do think that the ground is just too hard to preserve Carolina Bays as you move into the Piedmont and into the mountains and things like that. But not that they weren't affected, but they were preserved in the unconsolidated soils of the coastal plains and in the soft sediment out in Nebraska. So again, I do have some friends that are in this field. If you click to the next slide, we'll talk about a couple of them because these are guys that have been putting in a lot of research over the years before me. I tell them that I've been riding on their coattails a little bit because, they were into this, you know, really for 15 years now, 20 years, maybe. No, not quite that long. But so we have two guys that have two different alternative hypotheses, and they're actually completely different. The only thing that they have in common is that there was an impact into an ice sheet. That's the only thing that they both have in common. I'm sure you've heard of Antonio Zamora. He's been mentioned a few times. I don't have the comments up right now, but I'm sure that there are people chiming in with Antonio Zamora because he does have a YouTube channel. He's been, you know, very successful with it, and he does a really good job presenting his information. And the other guy is Michael Davies, and he's the guy who does the LIDAR. He's the one who who puts together the USGS LIDAR and makes it accessible for all of you guys at CentOS.org. So I highly suggest everyone go check that out. So if you want, we could talk about both of them real quick because both of their hypotheses are actually really important. And to me, I think that there's value in both of them. So if you go to the next slide, this is Antonio Zamora's hypothesis. Antonio Zamora and I are actually going to be speaking together at the Cosmic Summit this year. Nice. So you'll get an opportunity. That's right. You'll have an opportunity to meet Antonio. Him and I have been working closely together on a few projects. And so again, I do consider him a good friend now. Now his hypothesis links the Carolina Bays to the Younger Dryas. And that's kind of how we all kind of got into this field, was because of linking the Carolina Bays to the Younger Dryas impact. He thinks that the Earth did cross paths with a comet, and that one of those fragments, a large fragment, hit the Michigan ice sheet, the Laurentide ice sheet. In the Michigan area, he's kind of going a little bit further west, like into Lake Michigan, or even a little bit further than that. But it was chunks of ice that were launched from the site that came down, big boulders, boulders the size of football stadiums. These would have been huge chunks of ice that were launched into suborbit and then came crashing back down. And that there was viscous relaxation. First of all, the impact themselves created cone-shaped depressions. And the conic section is an important part of his hypothesis, where the impact going in creates a cone that spread out. And if you cut across the plain, you end up with an ellipse. And that's what we see in the coastal plain, is an ellipse. And so that conic section is important for his hypothesis. And that the impact creates such violent earthquakes that the shaking of the ground liquefied the soil, and it kind of locked everything into place. And so that's what gives you the Carolina Bay shape, the elliptical shapes, and how they're so preserved now. He does have notable lines of evidence, things like, and it does rely heavily on the Younger Dryas, relies very heavily on the impact science that they're getting from the Younger Dryas, things like the black mat layer that they found that has really high levels of platinum, not iridium this time, but it's platinum that they're looking for. There's also spherules, carbon spherules, and nanodiamonds, and this, that, and the other. I'm sure you've talked about that. Well, you talked with Mark Young, and he's right up there with these impact scientists. And, we also have biomass burnings that are preserved in lake core sediments and things like that. So there's a lot of, the megafaunal extinction is a big one. That's kind of what got me into it with Antonio, was, we lost all of these megafauna. I don't buy that we, with sticks and stones, the Clovis people, just marched across the North America and killing all of these mega mammals. That just doesn't fly with sticks and stones, that doesn't fly with me. So I do think that there was a bigger event. I think there was something more. Plus the Clovis people went, their culture went extinct too at the time. There was a collapse of the Clovis culture. And I think that's tied in with the Younger Dryas impact event. And then we got the Ice Age mega floods and things like that. So there's a lot that goes into Antonio Zamora's hypothesis that makes a lot of sense. And that's why I put it there as probability number one. You got any comments or questions about that right now?
No, that one's most of what you covered there. Most of this, I think, is pretty well known. Like this.
Oh, you froze. Dan, you froze. I can't hear you.
Points.
There we go. I'm sorry. You froze. I missed that. Oh, what was that?
Sorry.
You froze on my end. You froze up.
Oh, you're fine. Oh, yeah. I froze to the chat too. Okay. Basically, it seems like this is very much a similar hypothesis or extension of the Younger Dryas impact hypothesis.
Yeah. Well, it definitely gets called into the same circles. And that's what makes it controversial, because that hasn't been accepted yet. you know, there's a lot of back and forth about the younger Dryas that you know, and again, that's when, you know, Hoops gets brought up a lot. You know, why is he involved? I have no idea. You've got Mark Boslow. I know that Mark didn't mention him in high regards either. You know, he's just been a thorn in the side of these guys for years and years. And I think that there is plenty of good evidence to suggest that there was some form of cosmic impact that took place at the younger Dryas. You know, it just makes way too much sense that we did have an impact event. You know, right now the leaning is towards more of like massive bolide events. Oh, Dan, I think I lost you. Am I still in the live chat, the live stream? Well, let's see. All right, you back?
I'm back. Okay, let's see. Okay, good. Slides back. Hello, everyone.
I don't know if we lost live or what happened, but
I don't know either. It didn't tell me. It says if this continues, blah blah blah. So yeah, okay. I don't know what to say. Damn.
All right.
Okay. Yeah. All right. Basically, to reiterate, what I was saying is this seems like basically an extension of the standard younger Dryas impact hypothesis. A lot of the same talking points here.
Well, okay. And that's because his hypothesis heavily relies on that hypothesis.
Yeah. Just an extension of it.
Unfortunately, yes. And unfortunately, that hasn't been accepted yet. You know, there's been still a lot of back and forth. And as I was saying when you cut out, was that, you know, I do think that there is plenty of evidence to suggest that there was an impact event that took place at the beginning of the Younger Dryas. You know, there's a tremendous amount of melting. Again, I think right now the most dominant hypothesis is that it was a multiple bolide event, that there was, you know, explosions in the sky. And this would have just been a really, really, really bad meteor shower that was recorded in history. You know, there's all kinds of cultures that talk about it. So you're right. His hypothesis does heavily rely on the Younger Dryas as a hypothesis. Now, if you click to the next slide, there's another hypothesis out there that I think has plenty of credibility behind it. And that is Michael Davies and Tim Harris, Thomas Harris, who is their researchers together. And by the way, I think Tonio spent years working for a publisher, and I think he also did he worked for IBM. So he was a programmer for a long time. He was a computer scientist, you know, that they're problem solving all the time. And so I think that is an important part of this, you know, that he is trying to solve this problem, and he's using the same analytics, you know, for trying to solve a problem, you know, with computers. And applying that to the Younger Dryas and to these Carolina Bays. Same thing with Michael. Michael, he's been a computer science a professional for years and years. And again, it's all about problem solving. Now his partner, Thomas Harris. Now he's an engineer. He's actually a rocket scientist. He used to work for Boeing and Lockheed Martin. He did a lot of nuclear missile reentry physics and things like that, launch and reentry physics, which in this case, he can use that same, you know, the same science that he was using as a professional to track the, you know, the impact and the ejecta from the impact. And so they actually link this to an impact that took place 786,000 years ago. Which is a mid Pleistocene. Yeah, so it's much, much, much older. And that's kind of throws a lot of people off. They hear that age that, you know, oh, you're talking about almost a million years ago. That's crazy talk. You know, there's no way that sand can last that long. But we'll get into it, because I think that they actually may be closer to a accurate timeline. And I think that Antonio Zamora may be more accurate with his physics on impacts, you know, and secondary icy impacts. But because these guys, you know, like I said, their timing is way, way, way in the past. It's during the mid Pleistocene. But when you start to look into it, there were a lot of things that happened to the mid Pleistocene that may match a formation for these Carolina Bays. One being the AA tektites that are found all across Asia and Australia. A tektite is kind of like a meteorite, except that it originated from Earth. It originated from, you know, from ground and sandstone mostly. And the chemistry of the AA tektites doesn't match that part of the world. It matches Michigan. It actually matches the sandstone of Michigan. If you were to melt it and turn it into melt glass, that's what you get. And like I said, Tim Harris used the same physics that he would use for impact fit, you know, for ballistic missile reentry to track where we find these AA tektites back. And his origination point is Michigan. And it's, I mean, we had a whole conversation. He actually stayed at my house a few years ago. He was just in the area and I was like, come on, dude, come stay with me. And so, we had a long conversation and I was very skeptical of the whole thing. I was very skeptical. I thought it was way too long ago. You know, there's no way that these things were linked together. But the more and more I look into it, the more I you know, so for one thing, I think that this event would have had to be, I mean, it would have been a major deal. So if the Carolina Bays were created by secondary ejecta from an impact, it would have been a bad, like a super bad day, like an extinction level event day. And that's kind of what we see at the mid Pleistocene. And not only that, but we see things like the last time we had a geomagnetic pole reversal was at the mid Pleistocene. There's a huge extinction event with Pleistocene benthic foraminifera, which are microscopic aquatic organisms, a huge die-off, like 90% of them went extinct at the mid Pleistocene. And I think that we haven't caught up. We haven't, you know, we're still trying to figure out the Younger Dryas 13,000 years ago. But I think when we actually get into it, you know, I think that more and more fingers are going to start pointing at the mid Pleistocene transition as possibly a major impact timing. And I have a feeling that it's going to link to the Carolina Bays as well. That's not a super popular opinion to have. And at this point it is, you know, it's just an opinion. It's just an educated opinion. You know, in this, you know, a lot of people don't like it if I back away from a young, because I used to think that it was Younger Dryas related, and I 100% was on board with Antonio Zamora. You know, after looking into what these guys were saying, you know, I kind of think that the timing of their event might be more accurate, where the actual physics of the event might be more accurate with Antonio Zamora's hypothesis. And so again, it's whenever you have like two alternate hypotheses, you know, somewhere in the middle is probably where the answer is. And I think we need to start looking at that. And there's probably other things too out there that we're not quite sure, you know, that we're not 100% about yet.
That's science. But yeah, definitely bringing in the data from a bunch of different places instead of just rejecting it and then looking at it. And you can maybe find something out crazy. Yeah.
Right. Yep. So now, but what I will say is regardless if it was happened at the Younger Dryas or if it happened at the mid Pleistocene, I do think this was impact related. If you go to the next slide, we'll look at what the current academically accepted hypothesis is. And again, you know, this is the go-to. This is what, if you ask a geologist, this is probably what they're going to say, you know, created the Carolina Bays, is that it was wind and water over a long period of time. And there's a few reasons why they say this, and this is where it gets interesting too, especially for you, because a lot of the guys that are involved in the Carolina Bays are archaeologists. They're not geologists. Most of the time they are, they're doing studies on, you know, the Clovis people, and they're doing studies on Native American, you know, in sites that they lived at, you know. And so, you know, most of the data that we get comes from archaeology. And in fact, right there in the picture there, that's Dr. Christopher Moore. And he is what's really cool is he's also one of the like leading members of the Comet Research Group. So he's doing a ton of research on an impact event that took place at the Younger Dryas. But he is totally against the Carolina Bays being part of a Younger Dryas event. He's totally he's like, no, there's no way. And he might have a lot of good points. You know, obviously, when it comes to dating Carolina Bays, that's this is their number one go-to, is that the dating brings back all kinds of dates that are Pleistocene of age. There are some that are younger Dryas of age, but then they go back 30,000 years, 40,000 years, you know, and they're taking all of these carbon dates first, and then now they're using optically stimulated luminescence dating. And again, they're finding dates. There's like three or four different dates within the Pleistocene that they suggest as being the formation dates for the Carolina Bays. And when you think about it, you know, that it doesn't make sense that you would have alternating events to create the Carolina Bays, you know, erosional events to take care to create the Carolina Bays, but they all are exactly the same. You know, they all have that same elliptical shape, they all have the same orientation. You would think that over 100,000 years, for instance, that you would have variations, you would have these differences in the environment that would give you different shapes, and that's not what we see perfect ellipses, you know, every time. So yeah, dating is one of their most important lines of evidence for putting the Carolina Bays into various times throughout the Ice Age, not just at the Younger Dryas, which is fine. Again, I think that, you know, the Younger Dryas may not be the best timing anyways for the Carolina Bays. And what I think that they're actually dating in this case are erosional events. I think that they're dating times when there was a wind, because that's how optically stimulated luminescence works, is they date like sand grains, or they date a rock that's been turned over. And, you know, when was the last time that rock saw sunlight? And, you know, that's how they're testing this, and they're getting all these dates. And so I think that they're finding really good evidence for erosional events that took place over, you know, throughout the Pleistocene, the late Pleistocene. But I don't think they're finding dates for formation. I think the Carolina Bays were already there, and they're just dating the erosion that was taking place. Let's see. Yeah, if you go to the next slide. Go one more. Yeah, so this is their main evidence. This is really irritating, because they're all of the information that is putting Carolina Bays in a Aeolian and Lacustrian, which is wind and water, hypothesis, goes back to a 1977 dissertation paper written by Ray Kalzaworski. And this is so irritating, because this was never a peer-reviewed paper. This was something that Ray wrote for his PhD, and he had a group of you know, advisors that reviewed it and you know, gave him credit or didn't give him credit, and he got his credit, you know, he got what he needed to out of it. But the only testing of the hypothesis that wind and water can create elliptical shapes was done by this dissertation paper. It was in 1977. It was the year I was born. and basically what he did was he took a sand table. He burrowed out a perfect bowl shaped depression and filled it with water. Now, I don't know about you, but that's like the perfect definition for a crater. You know, you have a perfect bowl shape and then you fill it with water. That's what they started with this experiment. Again, if we go back to the scientific method, if you have a hypothesis, you have to be able to test it, right?
Sure. And, otherwise, it's not science.
Yeah, right. And so this is how he tested it, was by taking a perfect bowl shape depression, filling it with water, and then he took a fan and he blew it in one direction for 4 hours or for 15 minutes. They went 180 degrees around, blew it for 15 minutes in the other direction, 15 minutes. And he did that for 4 hours. And at the end of 4 hours, I guess 1977, they didn't have cameras back then. But this is the picture that he drew of the elliptical shape that he got. Now, that's not an ellipse. That's not an ellipse. You know, an ellipse is mathematical. You know, you have, you know, a length of the width ratio. There's multiple ways that you can proof an ellipse, and that would not qualify under any of them. But that's what they call it. You know, he called it an elliptical depression. And you know, this is how the Carolina Bays formed, and this is what they go to. This, they still cite it today. As a matter of fact, if you go back one slide, that paper that there's Christopher Moore actually wrote a paper, or I think it was a conference presentation, titled "Cal Zaworski Was Right That Wind and Water Created Carolina Bays," and there was a huge, you know, conference presentation about it. And it's like, no, this can't happen. You know, there are way too many things that were not accounted for, you know, the environmental variables. You know, again, if we go back to the scientific method, if you're going to test a hypothesis with an experiment, you have to verify your variables. You have to know exactly what's going on. One of the things that I teach is, you know, any change to any variable is going to give you an alternate, you know, your results are going to be affected by different variables, right? So any change to any variable is going to give you a differing result.
Sure.
But that's not what we see with the Carolina Bays. They have that perfect mathematically elliptical shape and orientation. It's not, you know, he made a great oriented lake is what he did. And that was what he was trying to prove. He actually got his PhD. You know, they gave it to him. He went on to become an oil scientist down in Texas, I believe. And he, you know, had a fruitful career and never went back to Carolina Bays. He was like, you guys can have those. I'm not getting into that, man. And again, that was back in the 70s. And nobody has done anything to advance this hypothesis since then. You know, they've been digging in Carolina Bays, mainly for archaeological purposes, using Cal Zaworski as proof that they're wind and water created. But there has been no experimentation to prove that that's actually true. And that's one reason why I say that these things are still a mystery. We still don't know because they're not testing. They're not even trying at this point.
Sure.
Go ahead. Do you have a question?
No, I was going to say that's I'm not surprised that when you're talking about things that big, it's not surprising that they don't get right. any testing done on a macro scale. And but just the one test that was done, that was the test you were talking about, was done in the 70s, right? Mm-hmm. The way the guy did it. Yeah. That's not going to, you know, that's a little bit outdated. Now you could probably do a little better, I would think, with computer modeling and stuff, I would imagine.
But yeah. Yeah, if you click to the next slide. So again, the one of the main Carolina Bays that Christopher Moore uses for his Cal Zaworski Was Right paper is Herndon Bay, and that's one that's been heavily studied for multiple purposes, mainly for like I said, archaeology. But if you look at the this picture, you know, Herndon Bay is right in the middle of that area. And if you click to the next slide, you'll see it under LIDAR.
Oh, wow.
right. And so again, so if wind and water created Herndon Bay, which again, and not only that, if you actually read the paper, not only do they say that Herndon Bay was created by wind and water, but they also claim that it migrates. They claim that you could track, you see how they have like multiple rims below it,
mm-hmm.
to the southeast, I guess, that Carolina Bay has been moving. It's been kind of, it's been moving forward, slowly over time. And I'm like, so if that's true, again, then what about all the other ones in that area? What about all the other elliptical shaped depressions that we see in that area? They, again, if we're looking at variables, they have to be formed under these same exact variables as all the other ones. If any change, any variable would give you something different. And that's not what we see. You know, any change, if you had a Clovis camp that was set up there somewhere, and you know, they dug a hole or maybe a mammoth that they were hunting decided to take a nap or hide out somewhere, you know, that would be enough to change the process. That would be enough to change the variables to create a different shape. And that's not what we see at all. That's not what we see with these Carolina Bays. They are mathematically, at least a huge percentage of them. I'm not saying that they don't change due to erosion over time, because they do. And you can see some of that in some of these pictures, but a vast majority of them have perfect mathematically elliptical shapes. Antonio Zamora is going, he's proving this by using things like the least squared method to actually go in and plot points around the Carolina Bays. And then, you know, you plug it into a computer modeling program and it will spit you out the perfect ellipse and it matches perfectly every time. You know, almost all the ones that we check, unless there's some kind of weird erosional event that took place that destroyed the, you know, the elliptical shape, they almost always match a perfect mathematical ellipse. And any change to a variable would give you something different if it was wind and water that created the Carolina Bays. But again, this is still the go-to. And I understand why they would think that wind and water created the Carolina Bays. If you go to the next slide, some of the first Carolina Bays that we were able to see from the air, again, if we go back to the 1930s, 40s, 50s, 60s, you know, from the air, the ones that they were seeing were in places like Cape Fear, which is a river valley in North Carolina. And some of these have water in them. Some of them, it's a floodplain. And so some of these Carolina Bays do have water. And so these are the ones that they were looking at, and they were like, oh, well, if they have water, then they all had water, right? That has to be what they are. They were all ponds. So if, go to the next slide. I mean, again, if that's true, then all of the Carolina Bays in this area had to have been a pond long enough for wind to shape a perfect ellipse. And then it just stops. That's it.
Weird.
And yeah. And then we have to also factor in the stuff going on in Nebraska. Again, you know, if you click to the next slide, you'll see the Nebraska rainwater basins. All of this is farmland. This is out in Nebraska. You can see the grid of the highways and all the farmland that we see all across Nebraska. Click the next slide and you'll see what that area looks like under LIDAR.
And
you could use a least squared method. You could actually, you know, plot points all around these elliptical shapes, and they are elliptical. Most of them are elliptical, and they have orientation that go right back to the Great Lakes. They go right back to that area of Michigan that we pointed out earlier. So again, you start to factor this stuff in, and it's like, what are we really looking at here? What is this? You know, how are we going to, how can we still say that wind and water created these Carolina Bays when there's so much evidence against it? And this is basic stuff. I mean, this is grade school science stuff, you know?
Yeah.
just follow your, you know, keep track of your variables and account for them. And that's not being done.
So. No. I should say thanks really quick to Samsonoff for the super chat. And we had somebody ask, what's the general size of these bays, just on average?
There are some of these bays have entire towns in them. They're huge. These things are really large. Again, if you go back to some of the images, you know, any of them, really, you can see how their entire farms just kind of go back and forth between them. You can see how, I don't know, like, miles, some of them are miles wide, but then some of them are a little bit smaller. Yeah. You know, you've got all kinds of differing shapes and sizes, not shapes, they all have the same shapes. But yeah, they're very large, very large. So again, how do we have a pond that long, you know, to turn into one of these perfect elliptical shapes, you know, and then now there's like no real evidence of that pond being there. I don't know. And we can look at, you know, sometimes, you know, they do get compared to oriented lakes. Sometimes they do get compared to oriented lakes that we find up in Alaska, a place like that. And I do have some examples of that. And we can move forward and look at that now, or we can talk about timing.
Well, yeah, whatever's clever. I've got about 45 minutes left. I need to get off here about 4.
Okay.
So my time. So
okay.
Just you know, whatever's most important to you, I should say. Sorry.
Well, I do want to talk about the timing because, like I said, me that's like, yeah, that's where that. But let's go ahead and let's skip forward a little bit since we're talking about the oriented lakes. Skip forward to like slide 39. I don't know if you have the numbers there or not.
I do.
So this past summer, yeah, we can come back to some of this later, but because I do think that there's evidence to prove that the Carolina Bays are older than the Younger Dryas, and that's, like I said, that brings up a lot of hate in my direction, because now all of a sudden I'm agreeing. Well, actually, I'm not agreeing with the academic scientists. I'm just disagreeing with Antonio Zamora and disagreeing with the younger Dryas, and that's become such a popular, sexy thing that you know, I get a lot of haters from actually finding evidence that suggests that it's not related to that, and that it's actually, it is much older. And we'll talk about that if we have time. So one of the things that often get brought up, and this is one of the things that I mentioned this summer at the Cosmic Summit, my whole presentation was called pseudo Carolina Bays, because we know that term pseudo gets tossed around all the time now. You know, pseudoscientists, pseudoarchaeologists, whatever, you know, it's being tossed around all the time. And when it comes to the Carolina Bays, they oftentimes get kind of like pushed off, like, you know, these things are, we already know about these. They're, you know, we see them all across Alaska, and we see them in all over, you know, we find them down in South America and this, that, and the other. Well, when you actually start to look at them, they're not the same thing. You know, the Carolina Bays are their own thing. You know, that elliptical shape that they have, it's near perfect, and the orientation is near identical every time. And these things are their own thing. You know, they're so abundant that, like, they're the dominant feature. They are the dominant feature. When you start looking at those LIDAR images, they're even more dominant than some of the river systems and things like that. And nobody's ever heard of them. They're not talked about. You know, we have things like LIDAR now. This should have been like the LIDAR when it came out. That should have been the showstopper, and every geologist in the world should have been like, hold on, look, can we go back and look at Carolina Bays real quick? Because it's telling a story, and we need to start reading that story, because it's not adding up. But no, instead, I included this list because every one of these came, I actually heard from a geologist that's in the field to dismiss Carolina Bays being impact related. Thermokarst Lakes is the first one. If you go to the next slide, you'll see an example of these thermokarst lakes. I don't know why this is like the most dominant explanation for the Carolina Bays. Thermokarst is basically, it requires permafrost. It requires the ground to be permanently frozen under a certain depth all year, like permanently all the time. And during the summer months, the top portions thaw out, and you know, you get water on top, snow melt and things like that, and the water can't seep into the ground, so it stays on top, and you end up with a pond. And most of these happen to be next to the Arctic Circle, and so there is directional wind, and we have, you know, a circulation of the water within these ponds before they freeze back up in the wintertime. And this again, if this were to be true, then we would have to say that all of the Carolina Bays in Georgia, South Carolina, North Carolina had to experience permafrost for thousands of years. And that's just not true. That's not what the literature says. You know, that maybe some of the areas like up in the Appalachian Mountains had some permafrost during the peak of the ice age. But for most of Georgia, most of the coastal plain, there's no permafrost. There's none. And so I don't understand why this is one of the biggest ideas out there, that these Carolina Bays were thermokarst lakes that they just happened to be in Georgia instead of Alaska. If you click on the next slide, you'll see an example of what they are in Alaska. And so you could, whoa, you know, I could see why somebody would say, yeah, they're kind of similar, but they're not the same thing, right? They're not the same thing. And I do have this under LIDAR. I did get Michael Davies to send me a file just for this area. He doesn't have it in his CentOS.org up in Alaska. But if you click on the next slide, you'll see what it looks like under LIDAR. And compared to what we have been looking at, and we'll look at an example real quick, but compared to what we have been looking at, you know, they're not perfectly elliptical. Very few of them have raised rims. We don't see very much overlapping. If anything, they kind of bleed into one, into the other. They're not the same thing. They're not the same thing. And if you click to the next slide, we'll take a look at, we'll just compare them to Carolina Bays. This is an area in South Carolina, and click to the next slide. And that's,
yeah,
these are Carolina Bays. You know, it almost looks like somebody took a cookie cutter punch and just started punching holes into the landscape of South Carolina. yeah, I mean, these are Carolina Bays. The other ones, they're not the same. Those are oriented lakes. Again, we have to assume that if the current academic hypothesis is true, that every single one of those depressions was a pond, and it had to have been a pond long enough for wind and water to swirl around to reshape the edges of the pond to create that perfect ellipse. And then they just stopped. That was it. We're done. We're ellipses now. We're that's it. But that's not what we see. That's not the same thing. There are other examples. That's the main one I wanted to talk about, though, was the Oriental sure. Lakes. They have Playa Lakes are often brought up. You can kind of quickly go through the next couple slides because it's the same thing. You know, the Playa Lakes, you have water that we find these in Texas where they get periodic water and it pools up. And seasonally, the water seeps in and then it dries out. And so you end up with all these like mud cracks and things like that. So when it rains next time, the water seeps in really quickly. And you know, there's some shapes to them. If you click to the next slide, you'll see the shapes. These are some aerial photos of Playa Lakes. Some of these are in Australia. Matter of fact, Mark Young, does some he's been doing his PhD research on, some of these lakes in Australia, which is pretty interesting. But if you click to the next slide, All right, so this is an area. This is an area close to Amarillo, Texas. You can see Amarillo in the middle there, and this is pretty neat. I mean, the Playa Lakes are cool. I just don't think they're Carolina Bays. If you click to the next slide, these are Playa Lakes, and so again, geologically, they're really neat. They're really neat, but we have a really good idea.
Well, as a layperson, even you can see the way the waters formed this landscape. You can see that the waters flowed across there, and that this is the pitting of the waters. It goes. I'm a layperson, but it seems pretty cut and dry to me by looking at that's what happened there.
Right.
Am I wrong? You're the geologist here. Tell me I'm wrong.
Oh no. I'm sorry.
I don't mind that.
I was reading the super chat. I do. Yeah. I mean, I think that this is how they formed. You know, the explanation for how these formed, I think, is true. But when I've had a geologist tell me, oh, those are just Playa Lakes. You know, we see them all across Texas. It's like, no, they're not just Playa Lakes. These are Playa Lakes, right? Click to the next slide, and we'll compare them to Carolina Bays. And so here's an area near Shaw Air Force Base. Click to the next slide. We'll see it under LIDAR. And these are Carolina Bays. They're not the same. They're not the same as the other ones. Again, you could see how the other ones were probably formed by water, right? And how water seeps in there. It sinks to the lowest point. But this, again, we have to assume now that all of these were ponds of water for long enough for that to occur. All of these have perfectly, I mean, you can see with the LIDAR how flat the centers of these are. I mean, they are so flat. You don't see that with the Playa Lakes. Right, you see kind of more of a cone depression in there, but you know, these are different.
When it comes to the age, you were saying about 800,000 years old is the hypothesis you favor, but the other one is for the younger dryas, basically.
Yeah, let's go ahead. So let's go ahead back. We'll talk about the age because that is important to me. So if you go back to like slide 25, So when it comes to the age of the Carolina Bays, again, so we have two alternative hypotheses. If you're going to consider that these were formed by an impact event, right? And so obviously, you know, the Younger Dryas is a very popular explanation for when these things formed. Antonio Zamora has been a big proponent of that. Michael Davies and Tim Harris, they think that they were much older. And it was actually a conversation that I had with Michael Davies that kind of convinced me, but it wasn't that he convinced me. I had to convince me. You know how it is sometimes where, like, you know, until you disprove yourself, you know, you're just like, whatever. I'm not going to listen to that garbage. And that's kind of how I was with Michael Davies and Tim Harris with it. You know, again, 780,000 years ago is so long ago. I was like, we're in a whole different ballpark. And the conversation I had was with Michael Davies, and we were just talking about he was telling me how the Carolina Bays are in a terrain that's pool table flat. that, you know, if you look at the coastal plain, it is so flat. And that's why the LIDAR is so important, that we have, you know, an elevation level of 1 meter and then it's repeating every 10 meters because it's so flat in a coastal plain that you need that visual aid to kind of help you see some of these Carolina Bays. Because again, you could drive up I-95, the main highway on the East Coast, and drive past hundreds of Carolina Bays and not even recognize them, not even notice it. There's people that live in them and they don't know that they live in Carolina Bays. And so having the tool like LIDAR is so important. So anyways, he was telling me about how the coastal plain is so pool table flat. And I can remember thinking, I was like, no, that's not true. I live in coastal Georgia, Mike, you know, I live here and we have sandhills, you know, it's a whole ecosystem that changes where, you know, it's mostly really flat swamp. But then you have these like old sandhills that have like gopher tortoises and a whole different community of ecology. And they're old barrier islands. They're ancient barrier islands. That's what the sandhills are, you know? And so you have this like up and down that used to be barrier islands, Pleistocene age barrier islands. And to prove, you know, that I was like, you know, hold on, Mike. And I went ahead and I pulled up his imagery. I pulled up his LIDAR to show him. I was like, look, let's just look at some of these Paleo-Atlantic shorelines just to prove my point that it's not pool table flat. And when I did that, I noticed that, I really noticed that it wasn't where we see Carolina Bays, it's where we don't see them. And when I started focusing on where Carolina Bays aren't, that really put the timeline farther back, in my opinion. Because if we think about the Younger Dryas, now that's at the end of the ice. If we look at the peak of the ice age, right, how much lower, how much farther away, or how much lower was sea levels at the peak of the ice age 20 some thousand years ago?
It's like 450 feet or something like that. I forget.
Yeah, it's like, okay, we'll just round it up like 400 feet lower, right? So at the peak of the ice age, it was 400 feet. And it was rising, you know, it was slowly rising until we get to the Younger Dryas. And then we actually get rocked back into an ice age. And so it's not growing. But at the end of the ice age, the sea levels were still much farther away. They were way on out there, right? So at the Younger Dryas, sea levels had not risen to our current place in time. So any event that took place at the Younger Dryas would be all over the coastal plain, all the way up to our current beaches, because the sea levels continued to rise after the Younger Dryas up until about 6,000 years ago. And then they finally leveled off around 6,000 years ago. So if this event took place 13,000 years, we should see Carolina Bays all the way to the beach, all the way to the beach. So if you click to the, well, click, go maybe two. This is actually talking about the sea level rise and things like that. But this image right here. So this, yeah. So, this is actually an area closer to coastal Georgia. And again, this is the area that I pulled up to show Mike that, you know, because I actually spent time on Sapelo Island. I go and do, I assist with research projects for grad students on Sapelo every year. And so I spent a lot of time on that island that has the yellow pin in it. And They would do field trips all to these different places to look at Pleistocene aged barrier islands. And so that's what I was pulling up to show Mike. And when I pulled up his LIDAR, you can go to the next slide, you'll see what I saw. Again, expecting to see Carolina Bays all the way across this terrain, because sea levels have not risen higher than they are today since the last time sea levels rose higher than they are today. At the time of the Younger Dryas, all of this was high and dry. You know, we should see evidence of Carolina Bays in every single square inch of land if they were formed by an impact, you know, at the Younger Dryas. And you could definitely see that the red marks that were zoomed a little bit farther away just to get in these different barrier islands. But, you know, the red circles indicate Carolina Bays marked by Michael Davis. And again, we see where they're not in between those ancient barrier islands. We see them on top of the barrier islands, but we don't see them in between them. Why not? There's only one explanation, and that's they're older than the Younger Dryas, and that they are not only older than the Younger Dryas, but they have to be older than the last time sea levels rose higher than today. Do you know when that was?
No, I don't. Like 40,000 years ago?
No, 125,000 years ago. The Eemian epoch was 125,000 years ago, and that's the last time sea levels rose higher than today. And we can see that on this terrain. If you go to the next slide, you can see it actually better in places like Myrtle Beach. So here's Myrtle Beach. You can see it's actually North Myrtle Beach, which is a very popular vacation destination here in the East Coast. Lots of people go here to go play golf and things like that. But you can see the Carolina Bays. That's actually one of the, you know, that first image we saw that was black and white. That's that same area that we first saw. And again, this entire area has been high and dry, you know, since, you know, the Younger Dryas. It hasn't risen since then. And it also, like I said, the last time sea levels rose higher than today was 125,000 years ago. The time before that, it actually, if you know, because we do go in and out of ice ages, right? We go in and out of ice ages, you know, every 100,000 years or so. Matter of fact, it's a big part of the mid-Pleistocene transition is we used to have ice ages every 41,000 years, and something happened at the mid-Pleistocene transition that changed that to stretch the obliquity of the Earth. The Milankovitch cycles changed at the mid-Pleistocene transition. And so instead of having ice ages every 41,000 years, we started having ice ages every 100,000 years. And that led to larger ice caps. That led to, you know, bigger ice glaciers, sheet glaciers. Regardless.
Oh, no.
2,000 years ago. The time before that was 400,000 years ago. It's not the last time the sea levels were fluctuating because they've been going up and down every 100,000 years or so. But the last time that they were higher than today was 400,000 years ago. And then the time before that was like 1 million years ago, and this whole entire area was covered in ocean. So 1 million years ago, sea levels were around 21 meters higher. And everything in this picture you see right now would have been underwater because it's, you know, wow, 70 feet higher. So that was 1 million years ago. Oceans were 70 feet higher than they are today. And this whole area is lower than 70 feet. So everything you see, every geologic feature that you see in the terrain here is younger than 1 million years, because 1 million years ago it was the bottom of the ocean. Okay.
That now,
if we right. And so ice ages started happening. Well, they were already happening, but ice ages were continuing to happen about every 100,000 years or so. 400,000 years ago, sea levels rose to 42 feet higher than they are today. That's a big deal. 42 feet higher. And then sea levels were doing their thing, going up and down. And 125,000 years ago, sea levels rose to 30 feet higher than they are today. Then they went down, and this most current ice age, they went way out. Like I said 400 feet out in this area. It was probably around, I don't know, maybe a, I don't know, 100 miles maybe farther away. And then sea levels rose. Now, if you click to the next slide, you'll see the LIDAR for this area, and again, we see areas where we don't find Carolina Bays. We see areas where we see really good Carolina Bays. They're in that area in the middle there, right? You know, that orange and yellow area, right? Where we first got the pictures from them. But if you look in the areas of red, like closer to the sea, they're gone. They're missing. Well, why are they not there? They should be there. Why are they not there? And the reason is because 125,000 years ago, the ocean had risen and washed them away. They're gone. You know, the ocean had erased them. We also see areas that are in blue that were, I think anyways, that we see areas in blue that were affected by the sea levels 400,000 years ago. I don't think it happened quite as long. If you see that area in blue on the top, there's actually some nice Carolina Bays, but if you start to look at them in more detail, you'll notice that they're really heavily eroded. And I think that's because that was, if you think about a barrier island, the front side, the side facing the ocean, has sea waves, right? It's got ocean waves, you know, and tides going up and down every single day. But on the back side of the barrier island, which is what we see in the top of this picture where that's in blue, that was all salt marsh. That was an estuary, you know, 400,000 years ago. And so I think that we see evidence of Carolina Bays that were survived that sea level rise. Yeah, and I think it's because it was a salt marsh, which is actually, it's a really easy way to prove this, is to go up there and take core samples. I haven't done it yet. I need to, you know, go up there and take core samples in some of these Carolina Bays, and if there's a thick layer of marsh mud in there, it, how did that get there? You know, well, it got there 400,000 years ago, which means that they have to be older. They have to be older than not only 125,000 years ago, but I think that they're older than 400,000 years ago. And but they have to be older younger than a million years ago, right? And then so if you look at Michael Davies's explanation of 786,000 years ago, and you look at all the evidence that they presented at the mid-Pleistocene, it starts to line up and it makes more sense. And one of the biggest critiques that I get is, well, what about hurricane storm surges? You know, we just had two major hurricanes that hit my area, you know, and down in Florida. Yep. And if you go to the beach today, there's still beach homes standing and things like that. You know, these hurricanes, yes, they bring storm surges, but we're talking about a repetitive action of waves, a repetitive action of tides going in and out every single day. That's what erases landscapes like this. And, you know, when people say, well, there's no way that they can be that old, those shorelines are that old. You know, we see the shorelines there. We see the ancient shorelines, the Paleo-Atlantic shorelines that were there 125,000 years ago. They're well dated. We can go to the Paleo-Atlantic shoreline that was created 400,000 years ago. We can go to the one that was created 100 million years ago. We can go all the way back like 20 million years ago and find the Paleo-Atlantic shoreline from 20 million years ago when all of this area was underwater, and we find fossils of megalodon teeth and things like that all over the place. You could find that shoreline. So if those ancient shorelines can survive that length of time, then so can the Carolina Bays. So can those elliptical shapes that we see in the Carolina Bays. And some of these are even truncated, like they are cut in half by the rising seas that happened during those times. So that's where I'm at with it. I mean, again, I think that was strong enough evidence to completely like, yeah, I had to be like, hold on. Cause I was all on board with Younger Dryas, boy. I was in it to win it. And this was like somebody just punched me right in the stomach, like for real.
Well, but yeah, you still got to follow the evidence where it goes. Otherwise, you're not doing science.
Right.
Whether you like it or not. Now, Ken Dewey's been commenting, talking about isostatic depression. And now I know a degree about this, but I'm sure a lot less than you. Like, I know that a lot of when they measure sea levels, they try to do it in places like Barbados, where the coral there is, there's like a minimal amount of isostatic depression. The coral there is pretty much damn near tree rings as far as telling you how water levels risen over time. I know they also like to hang out to do a lot of that stuff on the continental shelves and stuff where this is minimized. How much do we know about this as far as how much of that is hypothetical and how much of it do they have like actual replicable science or observable phenomena, I wish to say?
For isostatic rebound?
Please, yes.
Well, I know that they have a lot in areas where
Oh, shit. As soon as you start, you freeze up. God damn it.
Okay.
Oh, sorry. You froze there, so go ahead, try it again. Sorry.
Okay. If you go up to like Michigan, places that were under the ice, like they're doing a lot of research on isostatic rebound in that area because that was the area that was affected by it. If you go to slide 33, this is an area where we actually see adjustments in the landscape. Now, I can't say that this is isostatic rebound, but there is subsidence taking place here where we actually see the ground sinking over time. And it's well documented. You can look it up. You know, there's all kinds of data on the sinking of the Delmarva Peninsula. It's actually slowly but surely getting lower. And there are actually some really well-defined Carolina Bays on the Delmarva Peninsula. And if you click on it, you'll see that you only find them on that central peak. Now it's a little confusing because the ocean water is blue, but remember it's a repeating pattern. So as we go up, you know, going from the right side of the screen towards the left, you know, it's going up from the ocean and then it rises 10 meters and then it's flat level blue. And then it goes back, but that's where we find the Carolina Bays. They're like right at that 10 meters, but they're in that center peak. Well, what happened to the rest of them? You know, what happened to the rest? If you look on the other side, though, and this is actually lower. Again, this whole area has been slowly sinking. So we do find Carolina Bays that are under like 30 feet, which was that the last time the sea levels rose, they rose 30 feet higher than today. This area, we do find Carolina Bays that are lower than 30 feet. But we got to keep in mind that the area is slowly sinking. And so that's why we find them lower than 30 feet here. right? So there is some land adjusting in this location. In the opposite direction, if you go to the next slide, if you go down to Charleston, South Carolina, there's actually uplift taking place there. There's a tectonic fault here. And there's, you know, Charleston is well known for having earthquakes. You know, most people don't hear about them or learn about them, but Charleston, there's a fault zone that runs north of Charleston, and it's actually, you know, slowly rising. It's being uplifted, and that's what causes the earthquakes to take place. And if you click to the LIDAR, we'll see where the Carolina Bays and where they're not. And go ahead, click to the LIDAR. Click to the next slide. So keep in mind that 13,000 years ago, if this event took place, this entire area would have been covered. Same thing with the Delmarva Peninsula. The whole place should have been covered with them, right? Same thing here. Now, in this area, we actually, if you're able to, you know, go and follow the elevation lines or use like the Google tools to find out how tall you are or how high you are above sea level, most of the Carolina Bays are well above 30 feet. They're way on up there. But that's because the area is slowly rising. Again, this isn't technically isostatic rebound, but there is an explanation for why the Carolina Bays are only found on some of the higher elevations in this image, and it's because of tectonic uplift. It's actually being lifted up. So, but you are right about the you know, there are locations that aren't as affected by isostatic rebound. Places along Michigan, we find lots of it. I'm glad you brought up the Barbados, because I did my master's field methods course was in the Bahamas, and that's why we did a lot of climate change data, you know, looking at past climate change, past climate events, because of the coral, like as you mentioned, you know, the coral being way up higher, and so we were able to investigate it and look at it, and sure enough, 125,000 years ago, there's a coral reef that formed there. 400,000 years ago, there's a coral reef that's much higher up on some of those elevated areas, and so the last few times that sea levels were higher than today are well documented.
Yeah, that's it's interesting that some areas are really up in the air. Like when you go to spots like what you're talking about down there in South Carolina. Well, that's, I mean, it sounds like they're kind of watching it rise as we speak and seeing what happens. But other places like in Barbados and stuff, it's like they pretty much, from what I've seen, they pretty much consider that one almost immutable. That's just kind of like, this is how it is. If you want to know where the sea level was, go to Barbados, measure it, and everything else will have to fall in line with that.
Yeah, yeah. And there's so many other variables. Again, variables are so important when you're talking about this kind of stuff. But there's variables like the subsidence is taking place there. Freshwater removal, you know, the ground sinks because of that. We're taking out a tremendous amount of freshwater from the ground. That's causing that. One of the big ones too that really bothers me is the jetties and the seawalls and things like that that don't allow longshore drift to take place like it's supposed to anymore. Because people have million-dollar homes on the beach, you know, and they're trying to protect their million-dollar mansions, which none of us have. I don't know why, like, you know, it's like, oh, okay, somebody lost their million-dollar mansion, you know, it's like, oh. But most of the time it has to do with an interruption of longshore drift. Like it has nothing to do with, like, the sea level rising. Matter of fact, if we look at the timeline, if we actually look at the temperature, you know, graphs, you know, we've been in this current interglacial now for nearly 10,000 years. At its current peak, you know, it's been around 6,000 years. That's an anomaly. Like the fact that we have been in an interglacial as stable as this one has been for 6,000 years, that's a big deal. And this, you know, you can actually play into that as much as you want, because, you know, this goes into things like Hancock's ideas past civilizations and things like that. You know, our current civilization is as established as it is because we've had fairly stable sea levels and climates for the past 6,000 years. You know, that hasn't happened in a long time. So,
yeah. Somebody's asking about micronovas from our sun. From what I understand, micronovas aren't really science as much as they're like a hypothesis from just a handful. I could be wrong there, but
right. I'll say this, that one of the labs that I do with my students is we try to make a scale model of the solar system. And we do it by first cutting out the planets, right? And so if you have a planet that's, you know, about this big, then, you know, I'm sorry, a sun that's about that big, that the Earth is super small. I mean, it's really, really, really tiny compared to how big the sun is. The sun is huge compared to us. And so if there were to be some kind of like nova event, or even like a massive plasma ejection or something like that, ejection that was being sent from the sun, like we'd have no chance. Like it would just blast the entire planet, scorch the whole half of it that was facing the sun. I don't think that we would survive an event like that. I know that you know, that crew gets really passionate about talking about these things, but I think that if something like that were to take place, even Robert Schoch's hypotheses, I think that it would just blast the planet, and there would be no talking about it anymore. Like,
yeah,
we wouldn't be here.
So yeah, yeah. I tend to agree with you on that. That what I've seen about that stuff tends to be pretty. These forces are like, they're massive. When you talk about like this, the sun vomits 0.01% more electricity or energy out, and all of our electrical devices go on the fritz. I mean, there's these things are the degrees of power and stuff are just absurdly hard to
right.
So yeah, you talk about it hitting the Earth with with any sort of like real thing. If it's going to melt stone, it's going to irradiate the ground for about 10,000 years. So.
Yeah, Matt Bell had a guest on recently. I know you went on with Matt a couple weeks ago, and he was talking about it. And you know, I think he even brought up like the Carrington event, and he's like, yeah, at least this is how I interpreted it, that it wasn't as a big a deal as we make it out to be. You know, and we've actually had, you know, this past couple of days or a couple of weeks, you know, we've had auroras all the way down here in coastal Georgia, which is unheard of. You know, the once in a life, I told my students it was a once in a lifetime event. And then 2 days ago, we had another one. It's like, oh, okay.
Yeah.
But yeah, we didn't have massive grid failures or anything like that. So
no, that stuff. If we get to the point where that kind of stuff, like the Carrington event, I mean, if something like that hit today, it would definitely. I'm just looking around the room as an electrician, thinking of all the wiring, going, "Well, fuck me, I'm just going to catch on fire. I ain't even going to make it out this door. I'm just going to die."
That's right, what I was going to say. I was like, "Our the grid would be the least of our worries."
Yeah, well, most of us would just burn to death in our houses. Our headphones would burn through our freaking eardrums.
Yeah,
cell phones explode in our pockets.
Yeah, and you know, George says, you know, he's like, you know. He's way more terrified of a solar event than a cosmic impact. You know, that's true. You know, that's if something like that were to happen, there's no point in even having debates about it.
Well, I mean, yeah, we talk about meteors potentially hitting the Earth and wiping out dinosaurs and then life coming back. But, you know, about the time the sun decides to swallow the Earth, it's over. You know, once it solar flares us once, you're talking.
Yeah.
All DNA is gone. Yep. It's all cooked.
Yep. Yeah. Probably a good thing I can't see the comments right now. Because, like I said,
we're all right.
I hope they've been kind.
Oh, yeah. For the most part, there's people arguing anymore always, but I just kind of let them go. Research of reports of coins melting in pockets, not significant. Exactly. Yeah, it's like, yeah, that kind of stuff, man. You ever since I had an Atari, that kind of shit scared me, man. Come on, ruin the whole
house. You know, at the Cosmic Summit, there was Dr. Collins had a presentation about I think it's Abu Huraira. You know, and they found, you know, people that were, you know, melted, you know, flung against brick walls and you know, things, melt glass everywhere. You know, it was a terrifying event. And that goes back to a cosmic impact, a bolide event over that whole area that just scorched and melted everything. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I see that being more plausible than a massive solar event. Again, if that were to happen, the whole half of the planet would be like that, not just this place, not just another place over here. You know, now crossing paths with a comet tail, you know, not even the main, we're not even talking about the main body of a comet. We're talking about watching it. Like right now we have a comet in the sky and you catch it in the morning time, I believe. And that comet is making its way around the sun, just like we are. And our paths could cross its path. And that's what happens when we have meteor showers. And sometimes there's just chunks that are bigger in that tail of the comet that there's leftover debris, and we cross paths with it. And normally it's like, hey, let's wish on a star, you know, a shooting star. It's, you know, fun and interesting, you know, but sometimes these things just blow up in the sky. And, you know, the event that took place in Russia in 2013, Chelyabinsk, you know, that was a wake up call for a lot of people. And, you know, I wouldn't be surprised if we start seeing, you know, more bolide events like that.
Yeah, that's I wouldn't be surprised at all either. It's like I was saying before I brought you in, that, you know, that's the kind of stuff when it starts getting all doomsday, I just kind of shrug my shoulders. Well, I mean,
you and I have lived through quite a few doomsdays, so
yeah, it's one thing to prep for the Russians or whoever it is now to come over the hills. It's another thing all together to prep for the solar flare. But by the time the zombie apocalypse hits or whatever, that's from Night of the Comet. You remember that movie from our generation?
Yep.
The tail of the comet passes over the Earth, and everybody that's not in a steel structure turns into brain-sucking zombies.
Well, that, I mean, hey, there may be truth to that. I don't know. We have the Day of the Dead, you know, and that, that's, you know, that Halloween event that's going through the Taurid meteor stream.
Yep.
And there may be more truth in that than we want to give it credit.
That is an interesting thing. I, you know, this is the second Halloween that I've had a channel. I thought maybe I'd talk about that this Halloween.
It's, yeah, sure.
I know Randall Carlson's talked about it a lot, but it's a fun topic. Why not?
Yeah.
Oh, now we got people talking about Red Dawn and other stuff too. Yeah, Red Dawn and a bad blizzard. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Hail Bob. Yep. Yep. Oh man,
I spent New Year's 2012. In like a trailer out in the woods, because if it was going to go bad, I was going to be far away from anybody.
Thank you, Raymond, by the way. No kidding. The only one of those that in my life that really actually got me to like take notice was the Y2K thing. And that was only because I did know that some computers were not going to be happy with the way that played out. Didn't think
it was Y2K that we, it was Y2K that we spent, not 2012. Yeah.
But even for Y2K, all we did was me and a bunch of my friends. We're all just huddled around drinking beer and smoking weed, watching a tube TV on VHS. Yeah. It's like, oh, well, hopefully nothing burns up. You got more popcorn? All right. Make sure we got some of the stuff that cooks on the stove. We might need that in an hour. But yeah, it was that stuff was pretty funny. The number of, it's hard to explain even to people that are younger, the year 2000. The number of doomsday prophecies and things that just were attached to that, it was so fucking mainstream there for a minute. You would just turn on just NBC and then, this evening at 7, Nostradamus's predictions about the end of the world. My friends. And you're like, oh,
you know, I haven't heard anything from Nostradamus since then.
No. That's they were trying to fudge that one about New York with a 1999 and 7 months. They were trying to fudge that one up to 2001 with 9/11. I remember that was the last I heard any real mentions of him. Right. But that was funny. Yeah, for a split second. Yeah, Nostradamus is a fun little case study, the way that even like both the Germans and the Brits during World War II would drop off propaganda leaflets on the other guys, showing them how Nostradamus predicted they were going to lose. It was like that valuable. We're to donate money, time, and a plane to this. Like, good God. Hey, thanks you guys for watching. I really appreciate it. A lot of people saying that this was a great stream and they learned a lot. And I think, thanks guys. I really appreciate that. I make sure to go check out Chris's channel. I haven't put a link down below, but I'm going to do that as soon as we get off here. Because originally it was just going to be me. So I'm going to put down his stuff down below and change the title and whatnot. And you guys make sure and go subscribe to him if you haven't before. He's got lots of videos on this topic. Huh. But yeah, awesome, man. Is there anything else you wanted to say before we get out of here?
It was a third wheel. I jumped in at the last minute. I saw that you were going on. We had been talking about getting together. And I was like, I heard you rolling on the questions. I was like, oh man, I'm a jerk.
You were just fine. That was, one of these days I'm going to sit down and try doing it seemed like I was handling it okay. So one of these days I will try to just like sit down and talk to just the chat. But, the only reason I didn't invite you or anybody else, because it was such a short notice. I realized last night there was just no way I was going to have a video for today. And I was just like, oh, fuck, okay, well, I don't want to make anybody else jump over that. But yeah, thanks. I'm glad you were able to make it on. This worked out really
well. Yeah, well, we have tomorrow off too. It's Columbus Day. So
yes.
So it's always better if I have to do it on a work night when I have to go entertain, you know, 90 teenagers the next day. It tends to be a tough one to do in the middle of the week. So I'm glad we were able to do it today.
Yeah, me too. Awesome.
Yeah.
All right. Well, we'll go ahead and call it here. Thanks a lot, everyone. You guys have a great day, and we will see you next time.
All right.